And at 781-4515, our contact topic this evening, sightings of UFOs. The number 781-4515 here on Contact, the sightings of UFOs. As you know, from time to time here on Contact, we group around our table people who have an interest in not only in UFOs, but also in investigating UFOs. And they've all told me that 1965 indeed was a banner year as far as sightings of flying saucers goes. More UFOs may not have been seen, but it's a fact that more sightings were reported anyway to various UFO report centers across the country. So tonight on Contact, we'll hear about the rise in the number of flying saucers being seen around the Cleveland area and also around the country. And if you indeed have seen one, let us know about it by calling 781-4515. We'll also be answering your questions, taking your comments, and exchanging conversation with you on the topic of sightings of UFOs. In the Contact studio this evening will be Mr. Rick Hilberg, one of the directors of the American UFO Committee, the editor of UFO Magazine, Alan Manick, head of the UFO Report Center for Cleveland Ufology Project, and Earl Neff, lecturer on flying saucers and a member of NICAP. On the contact line to Pennsylvania, Mr. George Fawcett, active member of NICAP and of APRO organization. And later on, joining us after 11 o'clock, will be WKYC weatherman and announcer Ken Goodman. About 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, I guess it was, Ken Goodman, here on this program, told us about, I guess, one of the best descriptions of a UFO sighting that he was involved in that I have ever heard. So we've asked Ken Goodman to join us again after his 11 o'clock or 11:10 weather forecast up here in the studio and re-describe that event that happened at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, to you. If you'd like to be reserving your place on the line, the area code for those of you outside the state of Ohio is 216. The number, 781-4515. Now, before we get into a general discussion and get some of your comments, I'd like to hear from a panelist, both here and on the contact line. First, the head of the UFO Report Center for Cleveland Ufology Project, Mr. Alan Manick.
Good evening, Howard.
Good evening.
The Cleveland Ufology Project is a nonprofit fact-finding group organized for the purpose of gathering data, study and analysis, and dissemination of information pertaining to aerial phenomena. 1965 was perhaps the banner year in ufology as far goes. We've had many sightings, an average of 7.7 unconfirmed sightings of aerial objects. Perhaps the biggest one last year, and perhaps the biggest one, or the major report, was 9 October 1965. That's October 9th. Reports came through the report center number of 234-0861, and the telephone was ringing off its hook. 8:45 p.m. the first phone call came through. It came from Wade Avenue in Cleveland. The second phone call came through from Vega, the third from West 61st in Lorain. We saw a trend. Before the night was over, and the night meaning 12:45 in the evening and the next morning, 42 phone calls came in, all reporting the same object. These people did not know each other. These people all report the same thing. Many of these people sent in pictures of it as drawings, not actual photos. The night was a very drizzly night. It was cold. We called Hopkins Airport. The Hopkins Airport checked with us was 2,200 feet, the level of air. The rain was a very bad drizzle, like I said before, and this object was underneath it. Case Institute Technology was also informed. Radio stations WKYC were also informed. The object was actually a round, disc-shaped object with a superstructure on top. The lights were of revolving order, or sequential in order. Everyone had the same story of this. Nothing was seen protruding from this object. But these people were standing, either waiting for buses, being driven by cars, or in automobiles, standing outside. But they saw this object. And the most important thing about this object, that at arm's length, it was the size of a fountain pen. That's roughly about 4.5 to 5 inches in diameter at arm's length, which would have to be low.
What other sightings that you had at the report center throughout 1965 were outstanding, at least as far as you're concerned?
Well, Harv, really the most outstanding was one I just reported on, but we've had many reports of objects that were confirmed to be unidentified for the simple reason people have tracked these things from, say, Chagrin Falls, Wycliffe. We get another report call from west side of Cleveland, all with the same type of object. And checking with the satellites, with the Air Force, Hopkins Airport, Burke Lakefront. We have no, and weather report, naturally, we have no other confirmation of this, but of the research part of it. And the main project is, like I said, gathering data.
Now, most of the reports that come into the UFO Report Center, do they check out to be authentic, or do they wind up being something that's explainable?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that, because many people say that we're a bunch of nuts and we take in anything. We do take all calls, by the way. Most of them are stars or the satellites or an aircraft. We can confirm these. But the ones that are not confirmed, are definitely, there is some shape to them other than aircraft. They are not satellites. They prove to be not inversions. These have to be going down as what we call or reclassify as unknown.
And how many totally were in Cleveland during 65? You mentioned, I believe, but I didn't get the number.
We have an average of 7.8 a month.
7.8 a month.
Right.
And this is a high, and you've got to be about 85, 90 for the whole year.
At least, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll get to your questions at 781-4515 very shortly. On the contact line to Pennsylvania, an active member of NICAP and of APRO, and a returnee here to contact, a man that joined us about a year ago, and we had a very exciting program with him at that time. We'd like for him to bring us up to date on, in his own opinion, what's new in sightings on UFOs, Mr. George Fawcett.
Harv, 1965 was a banner year, and when you speak of flying saucers or unidentified flying objects, they're both the same thing, just names that are given by the Air Force and by the people who accept them as common terminology. But the Air Force, according to the report I received the other day, had around 800 sightings that they admitted, and about 19 or 20 they couldn't explain. The National Investigations in Washington, which is doing a tremendous job on this, had over 2,500 sightings, of which 400 were very substantial. Now, what was more interesting to me was the report in Look magazine, February the 22nd, 1966 issue, which dealt with the sightings up in Exeter, New Hampshire, where over 60 eyewitnesses reported a cigar-shaped object with blinking red lights on it that came down and landed and chased police automobiles and other pedestrians down the road outside the small towns and the big cities also up in New Hampshire. And this was documented by a newspaper man and written up in many magazines. And we found it very interesting because this was not published till February the 22nd of 1966. And we had a sighting right here in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, of an automobile chase on December the 10th with an identical sighting with the round red lights around the outer edge. And at the same time, about 3 weeks later, there was a movie photograph taken of these objects out in Arizona or one of the other Midwestern states, identical description in color. This was one of the better sightings here in Pennsylvania, and as a result of over, for the past 18 months, we've received over 80 reports of landings, 40 photographs being taken, and I know at least 48 to 50 magazine articles have been published on the subject. It was about a year, and here in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, we started a Pennsylvania, New Jersey two-state UFO study group, and we now have over 123 members, pilots, astronomers, amateur sky watchers, you might say, also doctors and lawyers, and people from all walks of life who are vitally interested in this phenomenon. Just recently, several weeks ago, over in New Jersey, above the Wanakee Reservoir, a round lighted object came down and cast a 9-foot circle on the lake, the reservoir. This object was seen by approximately 200 spectators, including the civilian defense director, the mayor of the city editor, the state police, and then the object moved over the local high school building and hovered for moments, returned to the lake, the reservoir, and after being around this area for 2 hours, shot straight up with tremendous noise. This report was widely reported in newspapers here in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. The next day, the Air Force said that the object, which had gone through these maneuvers and made this tremendous noise and had cast this searchlight beam down on the lake, had was the result of the planet Venus. Now, how wild you can get, I don't know, but some of the explanations are far more fantastic than what's being seen. The only other thing I'd like to mention here is that we feel like here in Pennsylvania we have established a definite correlation to many of the power failures and blackouts when these unidentified flying objects have occurred. We feel like that these electromagnetic force fields that evidently surround these objects have tremendous radiation effects and can stall automobile engines, aircraft motors, as well as giant power stations. And during the Northeast blackout, as well as other blackouts in Nevada and down in Brazil and up in Canada, and other places. It has been documented many times, and even in Mexico and Texas, that unidentified flying objects have been present when power failures occurred. So we've had a big year and a lot of excitement up and down the East Coast, as well as across the country and around the world.
Mr. George Fawcett on the contact line to Pennsylvania. You'll get your chance to ask your questions of Mr. Fawcett and my other guests and to make your own observations on sightings of unidentified flying objects. The number is 781-4515. Area code, if you're calling long distance, is 216. Another returnee here on contact. It's good to have him back again on a UFO roundtable type program, Sightings of UFOs. One of the directors of the American UFO Committee and an editor for UFO Magazine, Rick Hilberg.
Glad to be back, Harv. As Mr. Fawcett and the others in the studio did mention, 1965 was indeed a banner year for UFO reports. The main flap, which is a large number of UFO sightings, started in July, and probably one of the most spectacular cases ever was reported on July 3rd when Mario John Barrera, who is a commander of a Chilean base in Antarctica, radioed to his defense minister that there was something real causing electromagnetic interference on their apparatus. And in Buenos Aires, the Navy issued a communique saying that the object had been photographed at Argentina's base. This object was lens-shaped and was yellow, red, and green, and the colors would alternate. A Chilean corporal took the pictures, but they were in total darkness. About this time, the photo should be developed, and we're waiting to see any results. After that, on the 11th of July, in Portugal, strange objects were sighted in Portugal and the Azores. And at the Azores, a object stopped electromagnetic clocks. The first reported object appeared near the northern city of Oporto, where a man named Manuel Fernandez and his wife first saw something like a luminous flattened balloon. Fernandez, who was an employee of the Fishermen's Union, said that the strange object at first looked like a flattened balloon, but then when they both watched, it looked like a plate, a typical disc-shaped report. It was luminous. It was red. It stopped at a rather high altitude for 3 minutes, and then it sped off at an incredible velocity. In South Carolina, on July 12th, a UFO was reported by two gentlemen in a car. It was low. It was described as real bright. It flew alongside of their car. Right here in the Cleveland area, in Pepper Pike, on again July 12th, Mrs. William Carhis and her 11-year-old son Grant saw a brilliant UFO hovering over Shaker Boulevard. It was cigar-shaped and metallic. And in Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Maryland, on the 12th of July, a gigantic unidentified flying object was sighted and photographed. The experts said it was a weather balloon, but if it was a balloon, no one was able to find out where it came from. The FAA, which usually is informed on such matters, said that it had no balloons up at that time, and the only one that day was launched at Tyler, Texas, which couldn't have been over the area. There were many reports. Fred Kirsted at the Akron-Catton satellite tracking station said it was definitely Venus. The FAA said they didn't know what it was. On the 17th of July in Uruguay, a youth said he saw a four-legged object touch down for 2 minutes in broad daylight on a beach just out across from the River Platte. He was quoted as saying that it shot skyward in a blinding flash when a tug tooted its siren. In Anaheim, California, on July 21st, a woman and her 13-year-old son reported that they saw a round, color-changing UFO in the skies over Orange County. Mrs. Stephen Pello said the object was first spotted by her son at about 8:55 p.m. when he was playing at Maxwell Park. They went outside and saw the object traveling in a straight line to the northwest. It gave a white glow, but it slowly changed colors. It had arms of light, like rays. The big sighting, which made the headlines all across the nation, happened on July 31st and August 1st and 2nd and onward. Unidentified blips were spotted on the radar screen at the Wichita Weather Bureau, and which confirmed the presence of unidentified flying objects in the southwestern part of the country. After that, visual sightings came in from Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Kansas. The Oklahoma Highway Patrol said the Tinker Air Force Base at Oklahoma City was tracking as many as four on radar. and Tinker has, to this day, refused to confirm or deny the report. A Wichita weatherman said he tracked them at different times between 2 and 6 a.m., mostly on the south side of the city, he said. And I quote, "I don't know what we've got here. It looks about the size of a Cessna on the screen." A spokesman at McConnell Air Force Base confirmed that the FAA had tracked them, but noted that the FAA radar covers only a 30-mile radius, while the Weather Bureau covers all of Kansas. So indeed, something was spotted. Deputy Sheriff Everett Tucker of Wellington, Kansas, said he and his wife saw one about 4:50 a.m., moving rapidly to the north. He said it had a red vapor trail behind it. And sightings of four mysterious craft in a diamond formation came from Chickasaw, Cushing, Shawnee, and Chandler, Oklahoma. Police officers there in their patrol car sighted them, and they changed altitude and colors from red to white to blue-green, and they seemed to move from side to side at times. These are just a few of the many objects reported in 1965.
And we'll get to more reports during 1965 in just a moment, and you'll meet my fourth guest here at the Contact Studio.
This is HC with airline hostess Ella Talia, cruising high above the Atlantic at 600 miles an hour. Ella, would it make you mad if a mean little kid kept biting your leg as you walked up the aisle?
No, I'd just tell him to go play outside.
Would it make you mad if a passenger spilled hot coffee all over you?
No, I just scream and apologize for being in his way.
Suppose you bought a new 66 Chevrolet and found you could have saved $300 at Humphrey Central right from the start. Would that make you mad?
My, would that make me mad?
Save time, save steps, save money on your new Chevrolet right from the start at 7001 Euclid Avenue. Humphrey Central is a big dealership that will save you important dollars on your new Chevrolet. Don't make a doubtful deal elsewhere. Make the best deal at Humphrey Central 7001 Euclid.
For a Chevrolet, best in every way, Humphrey Central Chevrolet.
Humphrey Central is Chevrolet in Cleveland.
Sightings of unidentified flying objects are a contact topic this evening. I've been doing some reading today of different articles. One, I guess that one of the TV cameramen downstairs saved for me by a Jacques Vallée, a Frenchman who is a scientist here in America. I guess it was in the last October or so issue of True Magazine. It was one of the most fantastic accounts or collections of flying saucers that I've ever seen. Here's a scientist who is scientifically tabulated the sightings that he considers at least possible and come to some conclusions. We'll perhaps get to discuss some of those conclusions as to where they come from and what they're doing a little later on. Perhaps you have your own viewpoint, which you'll get a chance to express at 781-4515. Let me also say, before you meet my next guest, that a little later on, about an hour from now, we'll have a tape interview I did this afternoon with a very respected gentleman. If you're a Civil War buff or have read the book Andersonville, which won the Pulitzer Prize some years ago, I talked with the author of that book, Mr. McKinley Cantor, down in Sarasota, Florida, earlier today. And he reports, and this is a well-respected, dignified man of letters, a quite fascinating account of his own sighting of a flying saucer and some viewpoints about UFOs also being discussed. Well, we'll have that a little later on. Let me remind you, one, this is WKYC Cleveland, Ohio, NBC in Cleveland. Sightings of UFOs are our contact topic this evening. And now our fourth guest here in the contact studio, lecturer on flying saucers and a member of NICAP, Earl Neff.
Thank you, Harv. I'm delighted to be back again. As you remember, we started this ufology roundtable segment of Contact back on October 4th of 1962, and 2 weeks ago when you had John Fuller on and the lawman was discussing it, I was at home listening with one ear, writing as furiously to get down to Waynesburg to the college to lecture the next night, and I was very disappointed I couldn't be here, but I enjoyed every moment of it.
Has it been that long? 4 years almost.
Almost 4 years.
And I still haven't seen one.
But I thought it was one of the greatest programs I've ever heard, and reactions all over have been the same. Downstate, in Pittsburgh, everywhere, they said we've never heard anything as convincing as what John Fuller's done. And I might say that the picture that is the lead picture in the Look magazine of February the 22nd is also the lead picture in March issue of Pageant magazine. And this particular picture, having been taken by James Lucci of Beaver Falls, where I'm going to be speaking, by the way, on the 25th of this month, the college down there. I was the first to show this picture publicly at Carnegie Music Hall on October 8th, and yet it was just taken on August the 8th. It's a tremendous picture. And as Mr. Fuller said the other night, this picture is of the UFO is even more brilliant than the big full moon in the distance. As it was photographed through the camera these young men had out there that night as they were trying to photograph the moon. And the parts that come down from the UFO and the part that goes back from the UFO as it's traveling are apparently some form of ray that only the sensitive emulsion of the film picks up. I would like to say that one UFO skeptic plus one good UFO sighting, in my way of thinking, equals another UFO believer. And this, again, was proven the other night when Mr. Fuller was on. Seeing is believing. In fact, the late Dr. Wilbert Smith, who was in charge of Canada's Project Magnet, similar to our Blue Book, and it goes under different names now, said that he's quite certain that if a person, any place on the globe, would watch the sky for 30 consecutive hours, he would see an unidentified flying object. And recently, Chan Thomas, the authority on cataclysmic changes, said, if anyone wants to really see a flying saucer, they should go out there in the night sky, looking at the night sky, and fix their eyes upon a star. And as you watch this, you'll see, perhaps, activity around that star. I think that's probably one of the best ways of actually looking for UFOs. I've never looked for them. In fact, if it wasn't for our report centers and notification, we wouldn't half the time know what's going on up there. But one person sees it, and then we immediately notify the others. I think it might be interesting to mention a few of the classic cases for those people who perhaps have never listened to this show, if there are any of those. And, of course, starting back with Kenneth Arnold, sighting, that was back on June 24th of 47. He was a Boise, Idaho flyer. He was a businessman and had his own plane. He was over the Grand Teton Mountains. He saw up ahead of him, quite a distance ahead, nine silver objects. He referred to them as they were, as though they were saucers skipping along, or as stones skipping over the water. He didn't actually refer to them as saucer in shape, but back in the 1800s, a farmer did refer to something he had seen as saucer in shape. Then, I'm not going to mention these necessarily in any particular order, but Thomas Mantell, Captain Thomas Mantell to be exact, on January the 7th in 1948, was down near the Fort Knox spot. It was a Godman Air Force Base, to be exact, when he was notified, and his wingmen were notified, that there was something up there in the air, and they should go up and see what it was. This was the unfortunate incident when the captain lost his life. There was disintegration of the plane, and the Air Force later made a very ridiculous claim, again, as they have many times since, that he was chasing a planet. Well, Thomas Mantell, as I think I mentioned once before on this program, was a friend of mine who was in Air Force Intelligence at the time. And Mantell was a very fine flyer, and he didn't have an hallucination, nor did his wingmen. And then there's the case of the Lubbock lights, 18 lights that were seen by not only Carl Hart Jr., who was fortunate enough to have a camera with him and shoot the pictures, a couple of them, but four scientists from Texas also were there, and that was in the summer of 1951. And then there was the Captain Killian case, and I feel very interested in this particular case because I myself was fortunate enough to play a small part in it. Captain Killian and five other pilots in 1959 were flying their particular courses, and Killian's route brought him to Detroit. The man I interviewed in the middle of the night, called out of bed and went over to the airport to interview him, was Captain A.D. Yates. He had come here from Newark, New Jersey to Cleveland. And he was very reluctant to mention anything to me at first. In fact, I was very highly screened by some individuals in the room there. And later I asked why I wasn't being given the opportunity to interview him. And they said, well, you haven't enough credentials. Well, up until then, no one had asked me for any credentials. So I said, well, if he's the man I think he is, I'll show you just one bit of information that I think will bring him forth. This was the NICAP card. I had many cards with me that I could have shown, but I felt this was adequate. And then he came out after he had first of all asked if I would be willing to answer three more questions. Apparently I answered them to his satisfaction, and I later learned that this gentleman, with 41 other men and women, Air Force people, pilots and stewardesses, I should say, for commercial lines, were members of a group down in Newark, New Jersey, something like NICAP. They were very eager to get this information across to the others in the group, but didn't want any publicity through the papers. And he was so afraid that I might be a newspaper reporter. Well, this was a case where the six pilots flying their different courses had for 45 minutes all seen three objects in the sky. Later, when Killian came to Detroit, he was videotaped by Frank Edwards, who was with us here, you remember, a year or two ago, and an ICAP board member. And this was very interesting because now we have this in picture form still and his record of what he stated. However, he was silenced following that experience by his own plane company because they told him if he ever mentioned this again publicly, they would fire him. Now, when the Air Force stated that this was the Belt of Orion, this was a great insult to these men because, after all, flyers certainly know the Belt of Orion. And then when that didn't gel, they had other explanations. And so it went. Now, in February of the 21st, 1958, in Trinidad Island, down in South America, was a very interesting case that would take a long time to tell, but photographs were taken. And Kenneth Huffman in the local scene we have gone into on occasion, and of course I wouldn't want to miss...
Well, this was the minister.
The minister, yes, from the Grace Lutheran Church. And of course I wouldn't want to quickly say that in Washington 1952 was a great sighting over our nation's capital and White House, and the Sun-Times of Chicago Daily had the big screaming headlines, Saucer Fleet on U.S. Radar.
All right, we'll get to your questions for my guests, both in the studio and on the line, coming up in just a moment on sightings of unidentified flying objects.
Hi.
Hi. Don't you ever smile?
Only on my new job at Revco. Lady, I'm Larry O'Leary. Larry, the Laugher O'Leary.
The world's champion cheerful refunder?
Right. Smack me in the teeth with the unused portion of any product and I'm in heaven.
In other words, you only smile when people complain and want their money cheerfully refunded?
Right. A really indignant complaint can be sheer poetry.
Well, how are the complaints going for you at Revco?
Nah, I'm a little disappointed. I figured with that great written money-back guarantee, I'd really get a workout. But you know, Revco products are manufactured under rigid controls for highest quality, and prices are 30 to 50% lower. Revco goes so far out of its way to satisfy people, there just aren't enough dissatisfied customers at Revco. I don't get a chance to fulfill myself.
Oh, it must be very frustrating.
23 minutes now before 11 o'clock. I have a number of questions I'd like to get into with my guests based upon what they've said already, but let me defer to you and take some of your calls first. It's 781-4515, area code 216. You are in contact. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question and a statement that I'd like to make.
All right.
And my question is that in one of the November issues of the Time magazine,
mm-hmm.
It was concerning with the New York power blackout.
Yeah.
In one of the pictures, up in the right-hand corner, there's an...
Let me just interrupt a second. If anybody at home listening has a copy, this is a November 19th issue of 1965 the gentleman's referring to, and it's about page 37. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. In one of the pictures, I noticed up in the upper right-hand corner, I think it is, there's an elliptical-shaped object... if you have the issue there, it's quite distinguishable from any of the stars
Yeah, I have it right here in front of me.
Yes, I was wondering if any of your guests were familiar with this.
I know Earl has seen this. I guess, Alan, you and Rick have also seen this. Have you
yes,
not?
Yes, we have.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. George, are you familiar with the picture the gentleman's talking about?
Yes, I'm particularly interested in this viewpoint because of the blackout connection that I have been one of the first groups, I guess, to mention the possible connection and the more probable connection, because the number of sightings that occurred over New York and Canada and Pennsylvania and New Jersey, which are still coming into my house right here in eastern Pennsylvania, related to the blackout, where the not only was this object photographed and published in Time magazine, but jet planes were sent over Manhattan to chase the object.
Oh, well, this aspect of it, I want to hear from you in just a minute. Let me just say, and then hear from my guests what they have to say, that I noticed this 2 weeks ago when we did the program Lawmen and Flying Saucers. And, you know, I was turning the page, and I see this thing, which obviously looks like something of a flying saucer nature up there. I read the caption down below, and there's no mention of it, whatever, in the caption. It just says a view southwest from the Time Life Building, 20 minutes after the blackout, so forth. No mention of this object that jumps off of the page into the middle of your eyeball, and you cannot miss it. And yet there's no explanation whatsoever. So I called Time in New York City to find out, and I talked to a picture editor up there, and I said, well, what's the story? You know, here this picture is, and there's obviously something that could be misconstrued, perhaps, as a flying saucer. No mention of it. He said, well, we don't know. You'll have to ask the photographer. So I tried to get a hold of the photographer, Arthur Rickerby, and I finally did get his number, but I hasten to say, I forgot about it. I meant to call him before the broadcast tonight and didn't. I'd love to get the story. Now, that's my own experience with it, which is nothing. Any of you, Earl?
I can tell you quite a little about it, if you let me, Harv.
I'll let you.
Thank you. Arthur Rickerby of Life magazine made this photograph, and it was reproduced, as we say, in Time. I guess I was one of the first, perhaps, to write to him, and I was very pleased to receive from Amy Musher, writing for the editors, a very nice three-stanza poem, which was not done in duplicate. This was a genuine typewritten little poem, and I wish I had brought it with me. It's cute as a dickens, but at the last line says, no, it's not Mars, but Venus. Now, friend of mine, Mrs. Dean Deal from Lima, Ohio, on November the 14th, mailed me a letter, airmail, and in this, on the second paragraph, it says, a pilot, Weldon Ross of Syracuse, New York, reported to the Syracuse newspaper, Evening Standard, that on the night of the northeast blackout, at the time the blackout started, he saw, and this is in quotes, a huge fireball over the main Clay Niagara power line near Clay, New York. He saw flashes of fire. Item continued that Clay had earlier been pinpointed as the possible center and source of the electrical failure, but officials had checked it immediately and found no evidence before pilot made this report. Now, another friend of mine, Mr. Larry Moyers of Akron, from Flying Saucer Investigations Committee there, called Mr. Arthur Rickerby and spoke to him on the phone. And Rickerby said, well, it's possible, this is the photographer, he said, it's possible it could be a lens refraction, but it wasn't.
Had he noticed it in his negative?
No. Well, yes, he had noticed it in the negative, but he said it to, in answer to a number of questions, it could be this, it could be that, but each time he'd say, but it wasn't. So then Mr. Morris said, could it have been a UFO? And he said, possibly. And then Mr. Morris said, did you notice this object in the sky when you took this very beautiful shot of the blackout of New York? He said, no, I did not. Then I wrote a letter to Mr. Roger Pernjacquet of Geneva, Switzerland. He was very concerned about this. And later in the evening, when we go into this detector, this is the one that he'd invented, UFO detector, he wrote to me, can you possibly furnish me a copy of this immediately? So I did. I sent him an entire magazine, and he's even photographed it, and here's one of the slides he's returned to me and thanking me for it. But he says it's one of the very fine UFOs and is similar to the one he has sent me from both Australia
and from Spain. They look
Earl,
identical.
How can he, you know, without reservation, say this is one of the finest UFOs? That's a firm, affirmative answer. Now, this is a picture, and it's easy to say it could be a UFO, but can he say it is
picture? He went into great detail telling that the UFO was an elliptical object, and that the force fields coming from it formed the two cones, the one above and the one below. In other words, here...
That's purely supposition, though. He doesn't know that. He's saying it could be.
It could be force fields. They could be force fields, yes. But what he is saying is that on numerous occasions, UFOs have been spotted, have been photographed, and when they were, this particular effect was given, like in the one down in Beaver Falls, that the eye does not see. Now, these force fields apparently are not visible to our human eyes. But it was interesting to me that he said he had picked up four of the magazines in Europe and took them home. And he said, I was deceived. They were all black and whites. In other words, this is the Atlantic issue that they get over there. And where we have beautiful color in ours, they get them purely in black and white. The copy's the same, however. But I thought it was interesting that this should happen, to have aroused his interest. Here's a man who belongs to seven organizations. He writes for the British Flying Saucer Review. He is an engineer. He is the president of the big Paranjaké company over there in Switzerland, and not just a casual observer.
All right, Alan, you know anything about this same picture?
Well, yes. I'm not going to make any claims for it is or isn't, but there's one thing that there is a good claim that it isn't a flying saucer, and that is that in triangulation and with maps, and this is done with coordinate systems, this object, indefinitely in all appearances, is in the same exact place as the planet Venus.
It is?
Now, yes, it is.
The same exact place that Venus was at that night, at that time?
Night, right. But there's one thing. If you look at the lights on the street there, they are blur, and so is the planet Venus, but this looks like, and in all probability, is a light refraction of either a light in the street or the planet Venus. I will not make a claim for it as being a flying saucer.
George Fawcett or Rick?
I'd like to just say that we had reports here over eastern Pennsylvania of objects moving towards New Jersey. Then the Flemington, New Jersey News that night had reports of objects moving from there towards New York. Then the sightings by the pilot over Syracuse, New York, and near the power lines where the object was also located by some of the other people on the ground. And then since that time, sightings have cropped up all up and down the East Coast that particular night. And some of these objects not only in the air, but very close to the ground, treetop level. And going back into the history of blackouts, one occurred back in August 17, 1959, down in Brazil, where a engineer radioed in, phoned in to the chief headquarters of the power plant that his substation had been put out of action by an unidentified flying object flying overhead. And in the meantime, he told him that it was headed towards the main plant, the power plant. And the chief engineer went outside and saw it come over, and when it came over the power plant, the power was off there for several hours. Now, that was in 1959. Then in 1962, the Air Force submitted their radar had tracked an object moving from New York all the way out to Utah, where it landed outside a power station at Eureka, Utah, and shorted out the power station for at least an hour before they restored power there. And this was when the object landed nearby, and then the object took off and was chased by jet planes out towards California and exploded somewhere above California, according to the newspaper reports.
George, let me ask you on this. On this specific picture, though, in Time magazine, page 37, November 19th, let me just ask you and Earl and Rick also your opinion. Based on what you know, based on what you've seen, what information you have, do you think it is an unidentified flying object or a flying saucer?
I have not seen the photograph myself, so that lets me out.
Earl?
I myself have not formed any opinion. I have the knowledge that there is sometimes a lens refraction which creates images of this kind. The part that rather confuses me just now is what Alan just mentioned a few moments ago about Venus, because I recall earlier, Al, that you had checked the New York skyline, the buildings, etc., and against the position north, south, east, west, so forth, and that at that time you had mentioned to me that Venus was close but not there. Have you recently rechecked?
It was in that vicinity, Earl, but the elevation of this picture being taken has to be taken in effect. Yeah. It could all probably have been
Venus. I was just wondering what your change of...
And, you know, many pictures, we've had many pictures on our files that show light refractions claiming as UFOs.
That look like this.
Right, but then again, there are some that you do photograph that do look like this picture. So this is
I don't know for Harv myself if it is a genuine UFO or not. I was merely reporting what I had learned from Switzerland.
Rick, what do you think?
Well, I tend to go along with the Almanac. I believe that it is a planet Venus. I'd also like to ask George...
That large?
Well, since it was a time exposure, Earl, now you have to take that into consideration. Now, if you'll notice, the window lights were blurred, and some of the auto headlights were blurred, and also the object could have been blurred. And with the, and since it is a quite a bright light source, it's possible that it could appear to be a UFO. I tend to agree that with Al that it is Venus.
Do you agree, though, that it's a jet plane on the next page?
Definitely. It's either a helicopter, jet plane, I'm not sure.
Did you see that, Harv?
Yes, see that closer. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I'd like to ask George Fassett a question. George?
Yes.
Now, you mentioned that on the night of the blackout, you had received reports from New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Now, what sources do these come from? From people calling in your group or what?
Some of these sources, were the first one, the original one, was of two young boys who reported a large, round, reddish-orange object to the Voice of the People, WST Radio here in Eastern Pennsylvania. And they said it was moving towards the east and towards the New Jersey, towards Phillipsburg, New Jersey. But then from the newspaper account that appeared in the Flemington, New Jersey newspaper, a couple of days later, a couple reported that they had watched an object that night just prior to and during the blackout moving towards New York. And this was headed towards New York in a more or less direct straight line. Now, it seemed to have been directed also towards Syracuse in that direction near the... I can't think right now of the name of the airport there, but I know that there are power lines. In fact, the pilot himself reported that he saw the object, and he was sure the object was very near the power lines running into New York.
All right, we better move along and take that next call at 781-4515. If you're calling long distance, the area code 216. Sightings of unidentified flying objects. This is Harv Morgan. You're in contact. Go ahead, please. May we have your question, please?
Yes, sir. I have a question on this object that I have spotted on several occasions.
Okay.
And I was wondering if possibly one of the gentlemen there in the studio could help me out.
Yes, sir. I'll take that call. What did the object look like, and when did you first see it?
Well, actually, I've seen it over a long period of months since last summer.
What did it appear like, sir?
Well, to the naked eye, it just looks like a giant bright star.
Where do you see it?
Pardon me?
Where do you see it?
Actually, it's in the northeast part of the sky.
And where do you live?
I live on the west side.
Mm-hmm.
And upon looking at it with the naked eye, it looks like a real bright star. But I have observed it with powerful binoculars and a telescope. And under observation in this manner, it has a red light, and it kind of it flashes. And then on other times when I've observed this object, it is just a constant red light. Now,
and you say this is in the northeast you see this object?
Right, in the northeast.
Yeah, just it's stationary? It's just a stationary object?
Yes.
And you viewed it to...
This is the thing that is very puzzling to me. It remains stationary, so it couldn't be a plane or a weather satellite or anything else.
What time of the night do you see this object, sir?
Well, I've observed it many different times. See, I've seen this not one time. I've seen it numerous times. Now... My next-door neighbor is a member of many UFO organizations. He's an active member.
Well, what is the elevation of the object? Can you give that?
Well, gee, that's hard to say, really.
Well, see, there isn't right
several
now...
Several hundred feet, though.
Pardon me? I mean,
for me, it would be hard to judge, but it would be several hundred feet.
You mean any given night, you can go out there and there it is?
No, not any given night, but... I have seen it on different nights and at different times of the night. So
well, sir, when you see it the next time, you call 234-0861, and we'll try to get a triangulation on the object.
Right now, I
consider nothing there. There's no star that's that bright in that northeastern sky right now.
Right.
If it was overhead, I would call it the planet Jupiter, but even the stars move, 15 degrees an hour.
Mm-hmm.
What does your next-door neighbor say about it? Has she seen it?
Pardon me?
Has she seen it?
Yes, many times I've seen it, and I went to the door and got him outside with me, and he is the one that has the telescope.
And you see it through the telescope?
Yes, we have observed it, and because it is so luminous, so bright, you can't determine any definite shape to it.
I see, all right.
He has taken this information to meetings with him, and...
Which meetings?
He's a member of APRO, and...
Yes, we have meetings locally here once a month, every third... every third Saturday at the Cuyahoga Savings Bank building.
Well, I don't believe
Palma.
It's been with a national club of any sort. This has been a local club of which there are probably 20 or 30 members.
All right, sir. I'll have you. I'd like to have you call 234-0861 the next time you see this object, and we'll put a triangulation on it. We also have telescopes.
I see.
All right, sir. Thank you very much for calling. The number is 781-4515. We'll take that next call coming up on sightings of UFOs in just a moment.
With Black Label aftershave, feels like a plunging surf, like cool, like alive. Slap it on, she'll get the message. Yardley Black Label for guys who've got it.
6 minutes now before 11 o'clock. If you're calling long distance, especially those of you, let me throw out the invitation tonight in any of the 30-odd states that receive the signal of WKYC, that if you, in your own locale, have seen or heard of close secondhand information about sightings of your own, let us in on it tonight. Perhaps there are sightings that we have not heard of, especially, I guess, we very few, or at least I've heard of very few sightings down around the Central South, like Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee. Any of you down there who have seen something, let us know about it. Maybe we can correlate some information with members of NICAP and Cleveland Ufology Project and editors of UFO Magazine that we have here in the studio, as well as George Fossett on the line. Let's have that next call at 781-4515. I didn't mention, if you are calling long distance, it's 216. This is Harv Morgan. You're in contact.
Does the UFO ever try to capture or shoot down these unidentified flying objects?
Does the UFO try and shoot them down?
UFO.
Oh, you mean a UFO is an unidentified flying object. You mean does it try to shoot each other down? Or what are you talking about?
The people that, the companies that are in charge of it to send up planes.
You mean has the U.S. government ever tried to shoot them down? Is that what
yeah.
you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can answer that question. The U.S. government had a shoot-down order in 1952, but as far as we're concerned, they never brought one down. Many people, we have many cases where the object itself is proving to be a metallic or a material object was hit with these with bullets and also with debris that time. But as far as they ever brought one down, we have no answer on that.
I was just going to say, I was talking with an Air Force man just recently. He's still in the force, and I naturally won't mention his name or where he lives. But I happen to be in contact with him, and he said that at present it is absolutely true that they are supposed to take their planes and hover over them and do whatever they can to get one right down and examine it, of course. This is a ridiculous thing to do. By the way, I might mention that, speaking of these UFOs and their metallic substance and so forth, when Major Keel was here on the Mike Douglas show last year, he made a statement, and it was printed in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and I had forgotten this. But Nicholas Nestor sent me this proof, and I just got it in time for tonight's show. And on the Plain Dealer's Monday, August 10th, 1964, page 18, he said, this is Kehoe saying, in his pursuit of UFO information, Kehoe said he found the objects can fly about 9,000 miles an hour, that they are made of a strange metal capable of evaporating, and that traces of radioactivity have been discovered where the ships were said to have landed.
Now, with all this in mind, in the interest of the Air Force, here is a statement accredited to the Air Force by a writer for the Associated Press. I have this before me. This was last April this thing came down. He said the conclusion of the Air Force is there's no evidence that there are alien interplanetary space vehicles under some form of intelligent control landing in the USA. Now, as you know, the Air Force conning us on this, you mean the Air Force really believes that there are no such things as flying saucers?
No, they don't. There's Air Force Regulation 200-2. There's JANIP 146B, which is the Joint Army Navy Air Force publications. And I personally know I was in the Air Force, and I know personal friends that are still in the Air Force, and that were high officers. and there's definitely something there, and they're definitely concerned about it, and they're definitely gathering material, which is called Project Blue Book down at Wright-Patterson Field right today.
As a matter of fact, in this respect, let me mention that earlier, as I mentioned that McKinley Cantor, the author of Andersonville, will be on the program during the course of the last hour. I talked to him earlier in the day, reporting that he has seen a flying saucer. And he also passes along some quite interesting information about the just recently retired Air Force General Curtis LeMay and the statements that General LeMay had made, sort of off the record, to McKinley Cantor. And I think that will surprise you. It certainly surprised me, a retired Air Force general, making some of the statements he did concerning flying saucers. Our time is just about up for right now. We will have time to take more calls. In fact, we'll take more calls than ever during the course of the next hour here on Contact. If you'd like to be reserving your place on the line, the number is 781-4515. The area code for those of you calling long distance is 216. We're trying something different tomorrow night. Let me just take a moment that I have here to remind you about it. Of course, frequently on Friday nights, we have a sound-off contact when you get a chance to call in and sound off on, well, virtually anything you'd like to talk about. I won't argue with you all the time, but sometimes we'll get into a devil's advocate position, and I'll just, to be ornery, take the opposite side of something that you'd like to talk about. But tomorrow night, we'll try something a little bit different. A contact contacts you portion. Oh, yes, we'll be taking some of your calls. As usual, you can call in tomorrow night, but we'll also be making some calls to those of you who, over the course of the past year or so, have been dropping us some mail and maybe voicing some strong opinions. So we'll be calling some of you who have been writing in tomorrow night, sort of a reverse contact, and sounding you out on what you had to write about. That's tomorrow night here on Contact. We'll get back together with Rick Hilberg, George Fawcett, and Alan Manick and Earl Neff, and being joined very shortly by WKYC weatherman Ken Goodman. Back together following the news at 781-4515 on WKYC Cleveland, Ohio, NBC in Cleveland. It's 11 o'clock.
WKYC in
the number is 781-4515, Ufology 1966. Well, he's going to replace Martin and Howard when they go on vacation, I guess. Yes. Thank you, Ken. And we'll have another Ken join us very soon on the UFO program here tonight. Ken Goodman, WKYC weatherman, will be dropping in with an experience that happened to him a number of years ago, and I found it quite amazing, quite moving. We'll also be listening to Mr. McKinley Cantor, the author of Andersonville and the author of the newer book that came out a few months ago, The Story of General Curtis LeMay. Right now, let's take some calls for my guests, Earl Neff, Alan Manick, Rick Hilberg, and on the contact line to Pennsylvania, Mr. George Fawcett. Let's have that next caller. 781-4515. Puts you in contact.
Hello?
Yes.
First of all, I'd like to say that this question is directed to any member of the panel tonight.
Okay.
Well, on your previous contact shows on UFOs, the description has been, most many of them have had the description of a force field, whether it be magnetic or ionized or something like that. And when people see these, I'd like to know, what does the force field look like?
What does the force field look like? Well, can you see it, as a matter of fact?
No.
Well, on your one of your previous shows, you had a woman, I think it was from North Carolina somewhere, said she saw an ionized force field.
This was Madeline Rodifer
from Washington,
from Silver Spring, Maryland. And she was seeing quite a number of things that night, I think.
Yes.
In fact, I've never seen some of the things that I asked to see that night, as I recall. We asked her to send us some information, some pictures and all like this, and she, you know, said she would, and she never had.
I've written her several letters with enclosed stamped address, Don Lopes and all, but have never received anything. And frankly, I don't know, when a person is telling something like she was telling last night, why she wouldn't support it with positive evidence.
Rick?
Well, this is Rodifer expressed the opinion that UFOs come from underground caves, and the man who started this all, his name is Richard Shaver, and he started it in one of the science fiction magazines in the 40s, and curiously enough, this man was in a mental institution. So I wouldn't put too much stock into that story.
I heard this from other sources, though, that there are some people who, yes, indeed, believe that they not only come from under the earth, but there's one theory, isn't there, that they come, there was a whole civilization under the North Pole.
That's the Dr. Bernard. Yes. It's the same thing as Shaver. Deros and Demos and whatever.
Good and bad always.
Harris, does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Yes, George?
Let me interrupt just one second. I think it's not so important sometimes what people see as what happens when the objects are around related to force fields, where people report, as I've mentioned in earlier programs, heat burns, electric shock, temporary paralysis, dimming of vision, the loss of the ability to swallow properly, complete blackouts at times because of being too near these objects, either above the automobiles in the sky overhead or even on the ground.
As far as the blackouts of the lights and the dim outs of the radios, we've heard a great deal about this, but are you satisfied as UFO investigators that these things actually happen, Alan?
Yes, it has definitely proved that it has happened when UFO activity was in the area, especially low UFOs. I remember one case, and it broke in the headlines of the Cleveland papers here, and very large headlines, at Holloman Air Base in 1957. This was heard around the country, in effect around the world, where it stopped many automobiles.
Is that right?
Yes, at least over 40 of them, I guess, and people were standing out there watching it.
I think that, if I recall correctly, the newscaster here was telling me just recently, when he came in near the studio before we were on the air, that, what is his name, it was down at 11 o'clock at night on television,
Virgil
Downey.
Yeah,
Virgil Downey, yes. Virgil was telling me that when he was in the service, he saw a man who had whose car had stalled, and several cars ahead of this gentleman had stalled as well. And this man was interrogated at great length, and by the time the day was over, he was then hospitalized. And he said if he'd ever see one of these or had his auto affected by one of these again, he'd never report it.
All right, let's try to take as many calls as possible now in the next few minutes so we can play that interview that I had earlier today with Mr. McKinley Cantor. This is Harv Morgan. You're in contact. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to know the names of several ufology groups around the Cleveland area.
The ones that you might join?
And where do they meet?
All right. Alan?
Well, the Cleveland Ufology Project, which is in its ninth year right now, meets at the Cuyahoga Savings Bank building, and that's at 5835 Pearl Road every third Saturday of each month.
How can you get information about this?
I'm glad you mentioned that, Harv. We now publicize a newsletter, and anyone who is interested may write the Cleveland Ufology Project at 6434 Emory Drive, E-M-O-R-Y Drive.
6434?
Emory Drive, Cleveland 44142. And we'll be glad to mail you out some free literature and tell you about our publication and also our meeting place and what takes place at our meetings. We have fine films and slides, many lectures.
Any other organizations, Rick?
Well, this summer, the third annual Congress of Scientific Ufologists will be held in Cleveland. You might, the listeners, I hope, will mark this on their calendar, because on June 25th, from 2 p.m. to 11 p.m., at the Valley Forge Senior High School Auditorium, we will have people lecturing from all parts of the country, Mr. Gray Barker, author of a best-selling book, Mr. Jim Mosley, the editor of Saucer News, Mr. Gordon Evans, well-known New York science and UFO lecturer. And if you're interested in receiving information about the Congress as to the dates, time, and prices, just write to Post Office Box 2708, 2708, Cleveland 11.
Earl, what about any organizations?
Well, I'd like to, when you mentioned James Mosley here, I don't know if I should take the time right now.
We want to get as many calls as possible in right now. We can get into what I know you want to get into later.
I'll just say NICAP's a good organization in Washington, 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest. 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Washington, 36, D.C. And all you've put down are capital letters, N-I-C-A-P.
All right. But let's just put down the letter 7814515, and that puts you in contact right now. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Morgan?
Yes, sir.
I've heard that when telescopic photographs were taken of the moon from observatories over the world, that they have seen reported photographed activity on the moon from saucers, and that maybe for sometimes they have photographed fleets of saucers on the moon, and that the moon has been used as a base by other beings from outer space before we ever had intention of photographing the moon or studying about it. Is that true?
There was never actually any saucers seen on the moon. There were claims of some from amateur astronomers, but the actual astronomer, H.G. Wilkins of England, his job was nothing more than the moon, and he has made very many calculations. Professor M.K. Jessup, past professor, made a lot of studies on the moon, and there has proved to be activity, but it is unconfirmed yet as to what it is.
Proved to be activity?
Yes.
Proved to be activity?
Well, activity as far as light sources, different rays, craters being either produced or shattered or something taking place on the moon, yes.
Which could be natural phenomena,
right,
rather than man or creature-made phenomena?
Right, absolutely.
Are you pretty well, collectively, all four of you, semi-satisfied that no, there's no life on the moon?
No.
You're not satisfied?
No. Definitely not.
I don't believe that any life as we know it, and by the way, this is what the news media covers all the time. They're literally saying life as we know it. Well, we don't know about life as we don't know it. This is only supposition. But as far as life as we know it, well, we're going to be on the moon someday, and life as we know it from some other world could be there now.
But with all of the photographic evidence we've had from the moon that shows no sign of life as we do or don't know it, are no conditions where life could prevail as we do or don't know it?
Well,
you're still not satisfied?
No, we're not, because it's just too much, and also that back part of the moon with the two-thirds that we do not see.
And all of the bridge, Alan.
Yeah, the bridge, well, there's a lot of controversy on that bridge. It could be either a natural phenomena or something that was formed there, because I guess during the studies of this, the moon, and they've been studying it for 200 or 300 years now, 250 years, and there are certain spots that are appearing on the moon which shouldn't be.
Yes. All right, George?
Oh, and I'd just like to mention that even the Tarswella satellite, which is maybe up to 300 or 400 or 500 miles up, according to some of the photographs that they have taken, they have found no intelligent life on a home planet yet. And these moon probes, which have gone down to soft landings, if you can believe everything the Russians say, it's too early to say, because remember they said the same thing about the Mariner 4. At first, there's no life, no canals. It's just not the right place for life. And yet, just recently, this has been reputed by many astronomers, in particular Clyde Tombaugh, who says that he has discovered in the photographs the canals that were long years ago sketched by astronomers through their own personal observations.
As Alan said, though, there's much controversy about this. Well, let's get to the next call. 781-4515, put you in contact. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hello.
Yes, ma'am.
I would like to ask this. Since the Air Force hasn't made any statement concerning the presence of UFOs, could it possibly be that these sightings are being conducted by our country, and maybe for some reason the government isn't ready to release any information, because it seems to me the Air Force must know, or it doesn't know, and if it doesn't know, maybe it doesn't want to admit it.
Well, they've made statements as far as that goes. The statement is that, to their knowledge, there is no such thing as a flying saucer. I mean, this is a paraphrase, but I mean, in essence, that's what they mean.
But I know they have said that, and I outright feel it's where they have one of the big...
Yes, well, we believe here at the Cleveland Ufology Project, especially in... you can take in NICAP and American UFO Committee and the rest of the major organizations of the country... that we actually feel that there is enough information now to be said one way or the other. But as far as they're admitting it, they will not admit it openly. But I can't say secretly either, because there's too much documented evidence, too many people we know, too many things, too many regulations.
Yeah, but her point is this, though, Alan, that could these flying saucers be our own experiments?
No.
Would we shoot
no.
them down if they were?
Have we shot them down that we know of?
I mean, would we have a shoot-down order to shoot them down if they were our own? And if they're our own, we've only been off the ground some 60 years when the Wright brothers got us off the ground in planes, and these have been seen for many, many, many years.
Right.
Well, I think we could be told to shoot them down if it wouldn't, I mean,
we don't shoot our own people down.
Well, who knows? Have you seen people in them?
Well, in this kind of government that we have, it's hard enough to keep a secret, as almost any political party can tell you. In a secret like this, if it were being engaged in by our government, as administrations change from Republican to Democrat and so forth, and with reporters being as nosy as they are, I'd have to say, it's a purely a personal opinion, that it would be virtually impossible for this government to keep something under wraps that long. It was miracle enough that the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb, was kept a secret for the brief, comparatively brief period of time that it was.
Too many blabbermouths, huh?
Too many blabbermouths and too many political axes to grind between the two parties.
Well, you know, I'm on the issue of this. I'm not talking against them. I'd love to see them because they really can scare the dickens out of me sometimes. And that is just went through my mind, though. Could it be our own and for security reasons or maybe, I don't know, that...
No, they're not our own because they've been watching these, and these actual records go back and as far back as we can permit. And the same kind, the same type of sightings are explained the same way in the science and so-called top men of the world at that time all proved that these things don't exist. Yet this is before our country's even born.
Well, at one time the Air Force tried to claim that they had the UFOs. They were government weapons. This was about in 1955. I think it was in U.S. News and World Report. They broke a story saying that soon the Air Force will have flying saucers. And the craft depicted was a saucer-shaped object with some sort of louvers on it, and it said it would fly at all kinds of speeds and altitudes. And in about 1959, when the thing was finally developed by the Avro Company, and later by, I believe, NACA scientists, it only got about 2 feet off the ground.
Didn't even get above the curb.
A few inches.
It couldn't get above the curb.
That's
they
right.
Wheel it out of the hangar every time.
At least they did get it off the ground. Well, let's get the next call off the ground at 781-4515. That puts you in contact. Go ahead, please.
You have in the studio a couple of gentlemen who are members of the Cleveland Ufology Project.
Yes, sir.
And I would like to know what they have done to help NICAP. Now, NICAP is the only organization that is trying to bring this before the public by holding open congressional hearings. And,
What do you mean, the only organization trying to bring this before the public? Aren't any of the other organizations advocating that?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I disagree.
What's
with
your point, sir? Go ahead. What's your point, sir?
I would like to know what these... There is an article appearing in Saucer News, the March 1966 issue, where one of the members, Alan Mannix, is a signatory of the article.
Is this the James Mosley edition?
Yes.
All right, now, just for the benefit of our listeners who are not flying saucerites, this Saucer News is what? It says the official publication of the Saucer and Unexplained Celestial Events Research Society. Well, that sounds impressive. I don't know anything about the Saucer News.
Isn't that a private organization?
Yes,
this is a private publication by James Mosley, if I'm not mistaken. Am I
it is, yes.
Correct me if
the,
I'm wrong.
The organization is a local New York group, but the publication is actually separate.
But if you read my name under there, Fred, you've noticed the other names under there, too, and we're all banding together, and this is something new. It took 2 years to form this. No one has ever done this, and we're trying to do it. We're going to try to form this group together, and we're publishing information. This is the main purpose of it, is giving this information to the public.
This is not answering my question. My question is, what have you, as leader of the Cleveland Ufology Project, done to help NICAP?
All we can do is forward the information across to NICAP, and that's what we're doing.
What I have personally done through the many years as a member of NICAP from its inception is work very closely with Major Kehoe. In fact, Major Kehoe has even turned lectures over to me when he couldn't keep them, which is a great honor to me, personally.
Seems to me, though, because we must move along here in terms of time. We have so much left that we'd like to broadcast here tonight. One of the axes to grind, it seems, so let's clear away some of the clouds and get down to what we're talking about. One of the items in this magazine suggests, if I read this correctly, that the $7,500 a year paid by NICAP to Major Kehoe might better be spent elsewhere. That Major Kehoe perhaps has outlived his usefulness as far as NICAP is concerned, and let's take this money and give it to somebody else to do a more active job. Is this a proper representation of the essence of this suggestion?
Yes, that's what I have in mind. My question is this. What have these members contributed financially to NICAP? Now, I am very well acquainted with NICAP. I know the job that NICAP is trying to do. I know the sacrifices that Major Kehoe has made to help this along. And where would NICAP be without Major Kehoe?
Where would NICAP be without the people?
Major Kehoe has dedicated himself for many, many years. I don't know that if he gets 75 cents a year or 7,500, and I'm not concerned. He's done a tremendous job. He used to be in five figures, and he's taken an awful beating. He's been to the UFO what Billy Mitchell was to the plane.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we can't get more deeply into this split, I guess, among certain people involved with flying saucers, but we do have so very much to do yet tonight. I'm very sorry, sir. We must take the next call because we have two more things, two more major items to bring you. Let's have the next caller. This is Harv Morgan. Contact.
I was reading several years ago in a book, I believe, by Major Kehoe, referring to an incident in the western half of the United States, perhaps Arizona or Nevada, where a flying saucer was reputed to have landed, and this was covered up by the Air Force, and the area was roped off. A news reporter evidently gave this story to Major Kehoe, if I'm not mistaken, and he was able to bypass these roadblocks, go over this hill, and watch the Air Force officials looking at this saucer, loading it into a van, and perhaps taking it to a warehouse, which is supposed to be near Washington somewhere.
Well,
I wondered...
sir, I can clarify that. That came out of a book called The...
Behind the Flying Saucer
by Frank Scully, yes. And NICAP never made any claim to this. There has been repeatedly on and off suggestions that the Wright-Patterson Project Blue Book does have a saucer in coverage, but there is no outside proof of it.
Okay, sir. Thank you for calling. We'll take some more calls at 781-4515. I did mention two major items we'd like to get to, and that is two reports of very good flying saucer sightings. Ken Goodman has just joined us, WQYC TV announcer and weatherman. He had a sighting that occurred some years ago that he told us, I guess, about 2.5 years ago we'd like to have repeated. First, though, I'd like Ken and the rest of my guests here to hear a conversation that I had earlier this evening with Mr. McKinley Cantor. Now, Mr. Cantor is the author of Andersonville, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book a few years ago. He's also the author, co-author with General Curtis LeMay of the story of Curtis LeMay that appeared just a couple of months ago. I talked to him this afternoon and asked him if he would explain to us a little bit about some of the flying saucer events that have touched his life.
One thing I wonder about, you said in the article that you used to be a doubting Thomas. Now, you know, what made you change since you had not seen one at that point?
Well, I said I'd heard common testimony of too many experienced pilots and other observers. I didn't say that I was a doubting Thomas at the time, but I had been a long time ago, and then the evidence just seemed to mount up. There were too many people in a position to recognize that these things they observed were out of the ordinary. Hmm. I could not ignore their testimony.
Well, you thought these people were qualified to know at least what they saw.
Exactly.
What about your incident? How did your sighting come about of the UFO?
Well, I described that all in this article. I just went down on the beach in the very early evening, and I just strolled down there, take a little walk. My editor and his wife were here from New York, and we'd all been out together somewhere and come back to the house, and they were in mixing cocktails. I just thought I'd take a little stroll down on the beach. I went down and looked to the southwest, and here was this thing hanging in the sky.
What was the distance from you, approximately?
I have the slightest idea because I didn't know the size. But I knew it was motionless because it wasn't advancing toward me because it didn't get any larger. It wasn't receding at the time. So, because it didn't get any smaller, and it moved neither to right nor left. It was absolutely motionless.
Just sat there.
It was looked about like a half or a third of a, top half a third of a tangerine. Although, I had the feeling that there was a slight rim across the bottom. I could just barely make that.
Did it have any legs or these protrusions?
No, it's too far away to discover anything like that. It was high in the air. How high, I don't know. I just nailed the thing down to its relationship with the trees on a point of land where it was. And then the next morning I used instruments to determine the height at which it appeared. It was 11 degrees above the horizon. As for the compass reading, the bearing would have been anywhere from about 187 to 192.
Now, did anyone else see this with you?
There was an old doctor who came out to fish next door, and he had rented the house there, and I ran down to the old man. I pointed wildly and said, "Look, doctor, look." And he looked wildly around at the sky, and then he saw it, and I said, "What's that?" And he said, he's trying to adjust his old eyes to this thing, he said, "Why, isn't that two airplanes refueling in midair?" Because apparently he judged this, there was darkness on the surface of this orange metallic object. The way you get any round surface, you know, and reflect sun on it, the part that's brightest and shiniest will be in the middle. As a matter of fact, a beautiful woman's knee with sheer pose on looks that way. You'll notice when you draw it or observe it that the round part of the object nearest you on the curved surface is shiniest and brightest.
Well, I'm glad you noticed that too.
Too old to be aware of that. But anyway, I said, if it's two airplanes refueling in midair, aren't they headed in opposite directions? And he said, yeah, I guess they are. And then that moment it started to move with unbelievable speed. I've never seen any object move as fast.
From a perfectly still position to a...
It just took off, going into high into the southwest. Another neighbor appeared on the beach, my friend Dorothy Smith, right beyond. And I screamed, "Dorothy, Dorothy," and started toward her. And before I could cover that 100 yards or so, it was entirely gone.
Now, in your own mind, while you were seeing this and thereafter, did you try to discredit, you know, your own credibility?
No, not at all. I had believed they did exist. I thought, well, at last it's here. Now I know for sure. I just don't have to take anybody else's word for it. Hmm. I had, of course, screamed loudly toward my house to try to get my wife and my editor, his wife, out. The editor was the late Donald Freed, then the publishing company. But they had the hi-fi going and were making cocktails and laughing and talking, and they couldn't hear me at all.
Hmm. Now, you say in your article in Popular Science that you took this information to an Air Force colonel at MacDill Field up by Tampa.
An old friend of mine.
What was his reaction?
And, of course, he believed it.
He did?
Yeah, that's Mike McCoy. You see, the rank and file in the Air Force, I know scores of people, flyers, who believe in the existence of UFOs. There's a policy that would seem to indicate a high command. Put down a stricture on such information, on the evaluations. Now, General DeMay has denied that to me and denied it in print, that there has ever been any policy laid down by the chief of staff or any boards or anyone at the Pentagon.
What about this thing that so many of the diehard ufologists talk about, this Order 202.2 or something like that, that makes it against the regulations for them to speak to anyone concerning flying saucers? Anyone in the Air Force?
Well, naturally, you're going to get involved in some things that may be classified. That's a very good order, because there are classified things that haven't been made public. There are planes that, from time to time, that are under wraps. And you just can't have an easy conversation on this subject. There was a time when I myself was pretty top secret, and I was working as a technical consultant to the Air Chief of Staff. That was back in the Vandenberg days, however. But I wouldn't discuss UFOs with anyone, because I didn't be guilty of even unwittingly divulging some classified material.
That's what I was surprised you. You mentioned Colonel McCoy, and you mentioned General LeMay.
McCoy, he's the one that McCoy Air Force Base, formerly Pine Cat, was renamed for several years ago. He was killed up there in a crash.
But according to what organizations like NICAP say, these officers cannot speak, and yet they did speak to you. I think I see the reason why, though, on second thought now. We have not related yet that this sighting of yours was back in 1954, and this order probably has come down since that time.
Well, that could be. In fact, I think it did. That order may have been promulgated, and probably it was at a later date. But at that time, you were getting a pretty rough treatment from these people at Project Blue Book.
Now, Project Blue Book was the official Air Force investigation into unidentified flying objects, wasn't it?
Yeah, these people up at the right path.
Mm-hmm. Now,
I said to Mike, well, here's what I saw this day. And he said, hey, do you want to make out a report? And I said, hell no, I don't want some character coming around telling me I saw the planet Venus or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I knew damn well I hadn't seen the planet Venus. I mean, I've seen it plenty of times. I knew this was it.
Yeah. What did your wife think about the sighting when you told her? What did your wife think about the sighting when you told her?
Has been extremely jealous all these years since because she hasn't seen one.
But at the beginning, did she kind of look at you like...
Oh, not in the least. We've discussed it many times after I... far enough away from the job so that I wouldn't be unwittingly divulging anything classified to her. And we discussed for a long while I wouldn't talk about saucers at all. All I could talk about was this thing that I saw, you know. I wouldn't get into any general discussion on them. As I say, I was working for the Air Chief of Staff at the time, and I didn't want to break any security.
As Mr. McKinley Cantor, the author of Andersonville, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, and the conversation we had earlier today about his experience in sighting a flying saucer. We went on and talked about several other aspects of unidentified flying objects, so we had a chance to play for you at a later broadcast on flying saucers. Right now, let's get to some of those calls waiting on the contact line, because we still have that fascinating story that I've heard before a couple of years ago. I'd like for you to hear it from Ken Goodman. But to those of you who have been waiting, let's have your calls right now. A quick reminder, this is WKYC, Cleveland, Ohio, NBC in Cleveland. This is our Morgan, you're in contact.
Please tell me, have you ever heard of the Bermuda Triangle?
Yes.
I was reading a book, I think it's called Invisible Horizon by Vincent Gaddis, and it says in the book, it says, draw a line from Florida to Bermuda, another one, then it says another from Bermuda to Puerto Rico, and a third line back to Florida. And it has many disappearances of airplanes. And he has one on December 5th, 1945, at 2:02 p.m. when this is 5 TBM Avenger torpedo bombers took off. And then the first word came from them at 3:45, and they thought that they were going to have instructions to land. But the towers, people in the plane, they said, this is an emergency, and he says, we seem to be off course, we cannot see land, repeat, we cannot see land. And the guy in the tower says, what is your position? The radio towered back, we are not sure of our position, came to play, we cannot see just where we are, we seem to be lost. Then they asked, then the people in the tower told the pilot to assume bearing due west, the tower instructed. And then, but the guy in the plane, he says, we don't know which way is west. He says, everything is wrong, strange. We cannot be sure of any direction. Even the ocean doesn't look at all.
And when did this happen?
December 5th, 1945. It was at the Naval Air Station in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
All right, so is the essence of your question then, do the panelists here believe it?
Yes.
All right, let's check in. George Fassett?
Well, the only thing I can say, Harv, is that it's a well-known fact that they like the sightings down in Antarctica, they disturb the magnetic field instruments from 30,000 feet up. They can disturb radio and TV. They have been known to have affected magnetic direction finders, air direction finders, also compasses.
What about this Bermuda Triangle, though?
I read the article, the book, just the other day, and I think he's done a tremendous job of documenting many of the plane disappearances and ships also in the Bermuda Triangle due to some kind of, I won't say freak of nature, but due to some of the same characteristics that are observed when UFOs are near, too.
And do you connect the UFOs to these incidents, Alan?
Well, I would have to because it was seen in the area at one time. I think it was in 47 or 48 where there was one in the area. And since then, I guess there have been many planes going on. 17 in all, isn't it, Earl?
17 as far as I know.
All right, let's have the next call. Thank you for calling. This is Harv Morgan, contact. Go ahead, please. Yes.
How do you determine
when these UFOs came from Venus and what planets they came from.
Well, this is, I guess, a question, really, a personal opinion. Let's do a quick opinion poll right around here, Rick.
It's hard to say. They could be from another solar system. They could be from Mars. They could be from anywhere.
Alan?
We're not making any claims where they're from, but they're definitely, we believe, extraterrestrial.
Earl?
When we go into space, we're going to the moon first, then to Mars, then to Venus, we hope. And so naturally, if something's coming into our area here, they're probably going to use those as stopping off spaces before they come here. So therefore, they may be from beyond our solar system, merely using Mars or Venus or the moon before they get here.
George, what do you think?
Harv, the different descriptions of these humanoid beings that have been seen near the objects, in the objects, and outside the objects on the ground indicate that perhaps they come from many various races beyond the home planet. But let's remember, even on our home planet here, we have midgets and dwarves and pygmies and some people who seem to be giants compared to Mickey Rooney.
Yeah, but I just wonder if it stands to reason that they would be sending those that depart so far from the norm, rather than life as it really is in a normal state.
Well, they seem to be humanoid in appearance, and that they do have eyes, they do have arms and legs, and forked bodies, so to speak, and heads, and they're certainly curious, and they're certainly courageous, and certainly brave, and certainly have a lot of intelligence behind them.
All right, let's have the next caller. It's 781-4515. Quickly, this is Howard Morgan. Contact.
Hello, I was a few years ago, I came into contact with a book about flying saucers, and in this book there was a bunch of claims by people who had said that they had seen saucers and seen the people and gone in on for rides in these ships. And I was wondering if your organization has validated or investigated any of these reports.
Was that book by George Adamski?
I have no idea. It was quite a while ago.
No contactee, to the best of our knowledge, has ever been able to prove his point. And this has been what we have believed here in CUP, Clean Ufology Project. NICAP believes that. APRO believes it. I don't mean to disprove the fact that men like Lonnie Zamora, Socorro, New Mexico, the patrolman, didn't see creatures. Yes, creatures have been seen many times, but that doesn't mean that they talk in high German.
All right, we'll have more calls coming up very shortly at 781-4515. Let me take just a short break, though, while you're reserving your place on the line. To bring in a good friend of mine, a fellow who last visited here on Contact, I guess about 2.5 years ago, and at that time, I don't know, I'm still a skeptic, Earl, after all these years. I've never seen, one of these things, you call it what you will, a flying saucer or an unidentified flying object, but to me, personally, what I've heard with these ears from people that I know of or see with my own eyes, I think the two most convincing experiences, let me put it in that category of experiences that I've heard, was from Reverend Kenneth Hoffman, the Lutheran minister here in town, and from another Kenneth, Ken Goodman. Ken, I'm glad you could take time to come up here and join us, and I wish that for the sake of the listeners that perhaps didn't hear it a couple of years ago, could you just briefly relate to me what happened to you and when and where?
Mm-hmm. Right, Harv. As I said 2.5 years ago when I was on the show, I never really mentioned this to many people because it's the same old thing. What's he trying to do? We put somebody on. So I kept it very quiet. And in fact, my wife didn't even know about it for some time until one night I mentioned the lobby we discussed this thing.
You are secretive.
And I'm also very skeptical, and I can see why people don't really believe these things exist. And if you recall that night that I was here, another gentleman was relating his story of a sighting. And I made the comment to him right on the air. I said, I'm sitting here and I've told you my sighting. And yet, when you sit there and tell me your sighting, I tend not to want to
believe you.
That kind of thing. Well, it happened back in 1952, about February, when I was in the Army taking basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I never did much as far as any readings about UFOs, and at that time, we were beginning to sight quite a few of them. This particular sighting occurred, I would imagine, about 4:30 in the morning. It was still very dark. The entire regiment, our training regiment, was getting ready to board trucks to go out to the firing range.
4:30 in the morning?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
We get up early down there. And we were all lined up on this road, more or less at a rest position, waiting for the trucks to arrive. And it was a very clear night, not too many stars out, and we're just sitting around chewing the fat mostly. And a couple of us happened to notice up in the sky there was this bright light. Well, at first it was so far off it appeared to be just a star. Then it began to move just a bit, and we figured, well, it's another airliner, nothing much to do but look at the stars and sky anyhow. Well, the strange thing about this one was that it, all of a sudden, still a very small object in the sky stopped suddenly. And this, again, attracted our attention to keep focused on it. And as I say, a regiment of men were there. And we have later checked out a couple of these fellows who said that they will verify the facts that this was the sighting that we had seen that night. This we did about a year and a half ago with one of the UFO members here. At any rate, the object would then again move. It would be very erratic. It would go up, it would go down, to the left, to the right. And as it did these particular maneuvers, it kept getting closer and closer. And we started sort of guessing what it might be. Maybe it's a new helicopter or something of that nature. But the erratic movement of it was so fast that it couldn't have been a helicopter. And it kept up with this intense bright light that they always say the flying saucers have. And it got much closer to us. And it finally got to the point, as I say, continuing with these erratic maneuvers or just holding still for several seconds. But it was out there the total time, I guess, maybe 10 minutes. It was hard to judge. You stand there with these chills running up and down your spine when you begin to realize this has got to be a flying saucer. And it pulled up, I would say, from where we are in the studio here at 6 in Rockwell to the Terminal Tower Building, which was probably several thousand feet up.
It got that close to you?
Yeah. It was rather close, to the point where you could actually see portholes in it. And this was really the clincher that you had to believe this was a flying saucer. It was the oval-shaped type thing, the saucer shape. And the four or five portholes were very discernible. There was the light brighter inside the portholes than the actual glow of the saucer itself. They were very, very bright lights in it, so the portholes did stand out well. And then it did a rather strange thing. And if you recall, perhaps after the program, or while the program was still in progress the last time I was here, I hadn't known about the fact that other people had made this similar type of sighting. A bright searchlight sent a beam down from the bottom of the ship, and it would blink on and off. And it was a real weird thing to sit there and just watch this thing. And then all of a sudden, for no reason at all, other than the fact that I guess it wanted to go, it turned into a red glow. And all we could figure after it left was the fact that it had turned directly opposite from us, and we saw the evidently jet-type exhaust, because it turned into this reddish-orange ball, and within just a split second, just like that, it was gone. It just, and right out of sight. It moved at such fantastic speed, we just discounted any facts that it could have been something from this planet, because at that time, and even since then, I've yet to hear of any plane or any type object that we have, and that was back in 52, up to this present date, that could possibly go that fast or sit still in air and move as erratic as that one did. So our only assumption was that it had to be a flying saucer.
Now, you were outside the barracks, or you were already out at the campsite?
We were outside behind the barracks on a roadway. It's an area known as Tank Hill in Fort Jackson.
You know it very well.
Yeah.
I was stationed there myself.
That's a rough spot. It's the highest elevation in the area. And from there, you get a good view of almost the entire countryside all the way over to Columbia. And it seemed to be centered more between Jackson and Columbia, Fort Jackson and Columbia, South Carolina. But it was close enough that we could actually see these portholes we saw in the...
Even though it was dark?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, portholes were lit up inside. The inside of the ship was lit.
Mm-hmm.
And the light beaming through the portholes was brighter than the actual glow of the saucer itself. And I guess the reason it went, it's we started to get daybreak about that time. And while it was just beginning to get a little light in the sky, he just took off.
Right. How many people?
You said 1,500, didn't you?
Yeah, we had a regiment.
1,500?
It was a training regiment, which would probably be anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 men out there.
That's good enough confirmation.
This is why Professor Charles Maney, the astrophysicist, said it's one of the finest cases Ken he's ever heard of.
What about the immediate group of men, though, right around you? Now, you were standing in a cluster of how many men gabbing and...
I guess there were about four or five of us in this one particular group. I was a platoon leader, platoon sergeant at the time, and I had my squad leaders with me, and we were just up there. Of course, everybody was looking at it, sort of dumbfounded.
Now, what kind of conversation was going on between you?
Just the type of thing, gee, what is it? You know, what can it be? Has it got to be a flying saucer? Because at that time, there were a lot of sightings, but we were sort of out of it. When you're in basic training, you don't read newspapers and things like that. So we didn't know really what was happening to me.
Reading comic books.
Yeah. But that was a general talk. Like, it's just unbelievable, you know, that we here could see a flying saucer. You know, you may hear of other people seeing it and never think you'll ever see one. And then when the time comes, like I say, all you do is get these chills going up and down your back. And when I hear these other stories about people, this fellow on that you just now had...
Ken McCandrick.
Yeah, when he was talking about sighting it, you know, I could feel the chills going up and down my back again, because I know what he went through.
Because
if you ever see one, you get the weirdest feeling you ever had, because you know this thing's got to be from way out there. And you just don't... it's almost impossible to comprehend that there can be life outside of our own system that could come here and, if they wanted to, easily destroy us, because they have a machine that can get here like that. They sure must have the weapons to do whatever they want to do, but evidently they must be very peaceful and just checking us out. And that's about the way it looks.
What was the follow-up? Now, of course, you get in the truck, and this thing doesn't just vanish from your mind. You've got it in your mind, and the rest of that day and days to follow. What sort of conclusions did the guys come to?
There really wasn't much of a conclusion with the situation. The guys just sort of talked about it a little bit, but you get wrapped up in your basic training. You know, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you don't go to bed till midnight or 1 or 2, and it sort of goes out of the picture pretty quick. Whether the officers involved around the area made any report of it or not, I don't know, but nothing ever was said any more about it. It was just quiet, and that was it.
No one reported it to the, what is it, CIC or whatever?
Evidently not. No one in our area did. No, we just boarded our trucks when they came up and took off and figured if the officers want to do anything about it, why, that's their prerogative. We just sort of, as a trainee, you sort of stay out of it.
And there were no corroborating reports from civilians, say, in the Columbia, South Carolina papers?
I don't know. Like I say, we didn't read any papers. We had no papers up in there. And whether there may have well been, because I recall... later on, hearing reports, especially in 52 and 53, of a lot of flying saucer sightings throughout the southeast. So this could have just been another saucer that came along.
Now, to show you how very little communication sometimes there is, even at the same campus, I told you, you know, 2.5 years ago, at the exact same time that Ken saw this flying saucer, I was news director of the Army radio station at Fort Jackson on the very week, the very day, the very month that this sighting took place, and I didn't hear an iota about it. You know, and you would think that they're on the camp, that certainly you would hear something about it, but apparently, you know, news just doesn't get around. There was no blackout, as far as that's concerned, I don't think, was there? Do you believe? News blackout?
No, I wouldn't think so. I just don't know why it wouldn't have been reported. Evidently, it's a funny situation. Usually when your troops are waiting out on the roadway anyhow, the officers are never there. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. They find some place to sneak off and have a cup of coffee or something. So it may have been a case where really nobody of any importance saw it to report to somebody, you see.
Yeah.
And for anybody in a basic training unit, run up with lieutenants, hey, I saw a flying saucer. You know, you just really don't do it.
Yeah.
And everybody sort of relies on the other guy to have done it. Let John do it, you know. I don't want to be involved in it.
Right.
Type of thing.
I'm so glad we got a chance to rehear this story, because as it happened at the time, 2.5 years ago when we talked about it, I recorded the program that night, and I looked the other day all over trying to find that version of Ken Goodman's story of the time that he saw a UFO so we could play it on the air, and I couldn't find it. Now we've got it on tape again. We can use it for years and years and years to come, Ken.
Now, there's an interesting note there. I'd often wondered whatever happened to some of the men in my outfit over there, because it was a funny situation. I was a trainee platoon sergeant. I was the only official staff sergeant in basic training at the time, having been a reservist. I went into active duty as a sergeant, had to go through basing. And this young fellow who was my assistant platoon leader, I better not mention his name because I guess he really shouldn't have said anything about it, but he is now a captain in the Army, or was two years ago. And one of the UFO members here, what is the gentleman's name again?
Brian Akers.
Brian Akers. I gave him the list of men, about four of them, that I thought would be pretty much in the know. In the Army, you get a lot of people who aren't, and this fellow was pretty bright, and I figured he'd be one of the fellows that could relate a good recollection of the story. And he did. He wrote back to Brian. He said he was now a captain, but I believe in the letter. I didn't see the letter. Brian has it. He
showed it to me, Ken.
He did?
Yes.
But I don't think he could make any sworn statement, could he, or could he not?
Well, this one letter confirmed what you said.
The letter did confirm it, then, that he had seen the sighting with us.
All right, well, we just have a few moments left, and I'd like to take some calls for any of my guests, including the guest you just heard, Ken Goodman. Now, before we take that next call, very quickly, we had planned something else tonight, but we had so many ingredients to build this show with tonight, and one of the most important ingredients, of course, being your telephone calls. We want to make full use of your calls. We have a UFO detector. At least Earl Neff claims it is a UFO detector. Now, Earl... on the next UFO program we do, I want to go into this much more, how it works and everything, but just could you give me a little quick thumbnail sketch of it, and then let me hear it. I have not heard how this thing goes off or alarms or whatever it does.
Yes. Quickly, this is 10 centimeters square. In our measurement, I'd say roughly 4 inches square. It's a plastic box, clear plastic box, a hard plastic. On the top of it, there's a north and a south indicator, and as I receive it now, I am turning the lid around. This enables me to free the needle that's inside. The needle inside is like a compass needle, and there's a buzzer in here and a little tiny red ball. Do you notice this little ball here, Ken? And when the current is turned on, there's a little 9-volt battery here that'll last a couple of years, they say. And if the needle, which is like a compass needle, is placed north and south, true north and south, if a UFO goes over ahead, not an airplane, but only something that has electromagnetic force fields around it, this will activate this little needle. And in turn, the ball here that's on this wire will slide from the vibration from the one end to the other. So if you're not home, and then you come home and you've seen that the ball has moved, you get pretty angry, as probably you might shoot yourself.
Well, you are home. Can you hear anything?
Oh, yes, very definitely. And I'll just activate it for you now artificially.
Sounds like a Model T. And this sound then emanates, if you're home, you're in the next room, and you have this thing set up. And
it carries very well.
If a UFO goes off, anywhere within what range would you say?
Oh, a good long distance. You cannot place this directly near a big metallic surface. In other words, keep it out pretty much in the open or away from metal windows or something of that kind.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, look, next time we'll have a chance to go in and explain this a little bit more and maybe talk about the man who invented it. Right now, let's take one or two very quick calls before we have to sign off. This is Harv Morgan. You're in contact. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I'd like to report a sighting. This is just last Saturday, the 26th. I was coming out of the back of a drugstore in Willowick, off of Vine Street, and it appeared to me that somebody was shooting off firecrackers, and I happened to take a second look at it, and this thing looked like it was rising from the ground in back of two houses, I would say approximately 200 foot away. And as I looked closer, I thought it was a Roman candle or something, and I was seeing things. And I didn't want to believe what I was seeing, but as I looked at it, it was going up very slow, and it seemed to hover about the streetlight height, and it was shooting off. I didn't see no...
At streetlight height?
Huh?
Only that high, about 10 feet off the ground, you mean?
Yes, and then it was like hovering there, and then it went up very, very slowly. And I didn't see no cigar shape or anything like this. It was sort of a disc shape.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't see the actual disc, but you could see an outline of how the shower of sparks was coming out of it.
Mm-hmm. And was this exactly?
The shower of sparks were, they were coming down at a right angle.
No, I say, where was this? And what part of Cleveland? The west?
In
east
Willowick.
Side? Willowick, yeah.
And I'd like to know if there were any more sightings of this thing. And this was approximately 9:45, or 9:50.
Last Saturday night.
Yes.
No, there wasn't, but the object you're referring to, it seems to be awful small, a small-type object. This could definitely be a ball-type lightning object, but I'm not certain about it.
Well, mm-hmm. I looked at it, and it was there, I would say about 5 to 6 seconds. And then I thought it was just maybe an optical illusion or a light reflection, and all of a sudden it's just like I saw a light go past at a right angle, and off in the distance I saw another shower of sparks, and then it was gone.
Well, I'm sorry, sir, we won't have time to get any more of an answer from any of our other guests, because that is our time for this evening. My apologies first to those of you waiting on the line who could not get your call answered or your statements heard. My thanks, special thanks, to George Fawcett on the contact line, to Pennsylvania, in the contact studio, Rick Hilberg, one of the directors of American UFO Committee and the editor of UFO Magazine, Alan Manick, head of UFO Report Center for the Cleveland Ufology Project, and to Earl Knapp, lecturer on flying saucers and a member of NICAP. And also my thanks to a late joiner, Ken Goodman, WKYC-TV announcer and weatherman, for relating his experience of 1952 to us, in which a large number of people were involved in that sighting. And to Mr. McKinley Catter of Florida now, the author of Andersonville, for telling us his experience with a flying saucer. Once again, Earl, can we hear that UFO? Next time we'll have a chance to go more into the UFO detector here on Contact. Produced by Bob Conroy. Engineering by Gerald L. Smith. This is WKYC Cleveland, Ohio, NBC in Cleveland. Tomorrow night, a sound-off night here on Contact. And I hope at that time you will be in contact. This is Harv Morgan. Good night.